Thursday, April 16th. This morning began with breakfast with Lyndon, and then several hours of work with Liz on the speech before the YWCA in Cleveland. It's just not possible for me to get somebody else to write completely a speech for me unless we are so in the groove together and think the same things about the subject. So I had to remember what points of contact I had had with the YWCA about opening their International Food Fair, about Lucy taking life-saving lessons in the Y's swimming pool, then call the matron of the local Y residence and get some stories from her on the typical story of a young girl fresh out of high school from a small town who comes to Washington and lives in the Y and gets a job in government. What it means to her, in other words, I have to live it before I can translate it a little bit into a speech. And then at 1 o'clock, there came one of those things that I think must be peculiarly American, a small gesture of our national feeling for the individual. Senator Margaret Chase Smith had written me a most tender letter asking me if I would receive a crippled girl, Nancy Martin, a young high school student who has cancer of the spine, who is in a wheelchair, and who is destined to have a short life. We arranged for her to have a very special tour of the White House, and then I went down and met her at the south entrance, gave her one of the etchings of the White House, and we chatted a bit on the warm spring sunshine of the south lawn, while him and her barreled across the lawn, chasing each other's tails, and Blanco, that beautiful white collie, added a special grace to the scene. Nancy had made the whole trip in an ambulance, accompanied by her mother and her half-brother. She was cheerful, bright, determined to see the town, and, I am told, completely aware of her short life expectancy. In the afternoon, I worked on the mail, and then was overcome with one of those great needs to take a nap, which I did at the most inappropriate time, while Lyndon was having a press conference in the State Department auditorium at 4:30, which turned out to be the best one he's had up to now, everybody agrees. Dr. Hirsch is arriving this afternoon, and I've given directions to have him upstairs as our house guest and down for dinner. At 5 o'clock, Diana, Gary, and Jack Hopkins, and their two children, and Dr. Blake Smith of Austin came, and also Gary's friend from school days, a very attractive young woman. They had just finished a good tour of the first floor, and so I showed them the second with all the details, and then settled down for tea. After dispatching young Tony and young Jack with Diana's housekeeper for a tour of the grounds, a glimpse at the swimming pool, and then to ride home. Gary was aglow with her adventure, this trip. And high time it is, because you can't avoid thinking that somehow she has risen less to the tide of opportunity than Diana and has not had such an exciting life. Dr. Blake Smith brought me the unwelcome news, which I already knew, and which I actually had to kind of prize out of him, that we are having trouble in Austin, my so successful, so beloved hometown, on the integration problem. It seems the more radical Negro leaders have simply moved in on the city council, a sort of sit-in within the chamber itself. And the mayor, poor soul, has actually gone to the hospital from complete exhaustion. We've done so well. I'm afraid they'll use up their store of goodwill among the citizenry, and we'll be in for a bad time in that blessed town. While we were sitting there very peacefully, I got word from Lyndon that he was bringing over some of the Texas editors and their wives. First it was going to be 15, presently it was going to be 40, so I sent a quick SOS to the kitchen to get some drinks ready. We'd do it in the over room and some hors d'oeuvres. And I said goodbye to Diana and her party just in time to start meeting the Texas editors. Old-timers all, the Charlie Greens, the Charlie Guys, Bill Hobby alone, Diana was at home, Bill Hooten, the Ray Howards, she is always the ultimate of refinement, and very pretty in blue, Walter Humphrey, the Wes Izzards, the Bob Jacksons, and I'm happy to say that Bob looks 5 years younger and much stronger than he did 5 years ago. His heart attack is in the background now. The Frank Mabons, the J.Q. Mahaffey's, grinning as usual. I always like to see somebody from real close to home. I'm sorry I never did run into Mr. Woody. The Harry Provinces, and there was much talk about his book. Walter Jenkins, Cliff Carter, and Jack Valenti came over to help out. Lyndon himself was completely in charge of everything. He took everybody out on the balcony, the Truman balcony, to show them the gardens below and the monuments. We went filing through all the rooms. Ruth Johnson, Mrs. J. Lee Johnson, was there, and we have plans to meet tomorrow morning. After they left, we had the sort of dinner I'd been planning and wanting ever since Lady Jackson arrived. Just Lady Jackson, Dr. Hurst, and us. Lady Jackson talked, and Lyndon listened, something he doesn't often do, especially to women, but he is fascinated by her. And so am I. She spoke of the possibility that a lot of the money saved and people put out of work by the closing of the bases under McNamara's program might be used in some sort of pilot program for urban renewal to make a model city and the surroundings thereof, to make traffic something that we could live with. The nice thing about her is that she considers that everything is possible, brightly possible. She herself has had an interesting life, and though she is away from her husband a great deal, lecturing, teaching, and wrapped up in her own career of writing books, the best known of which, I guess, is The Rich Nations and the Poor Nations, she is nevertheless very close to her husband. They have a 10-year-old son. I judge he was born fairly late in her life. And he, poor dear, is off at boarding school. That's something about the British I just don't get. I'd have to send mine flailing and screaming at 16. Whereas over there, a little boy, when he gets about 8, just naturally goes, and if he doesn't get sent, he says, "What do you think I am, a baby?" She envisions the next few decades as possibly the greatest in the history of mankind. Automation can be turned into a vast blessing instead of a curse. Our natural resources are so great. The inventiveness of man's mind so boundless that at last we have it in our grasp to build a really new society offering more for everybody. Or at least that's my synthesis after listening to her. Earlier in the day, I had commandeered about 30 minutes of her time, along with Liz, to give me some pointers about my YWCA speech. And she did produce several pages which found their way into the finished product. And I had asked her, much more important, to please think about and work on a little, if she could sandwich me in between her work for the man himself, the speech I'm going to have to do at Radcliffe in June. She seemed not only willing, but quite eager to help on that, and said, "The Radcliffe girls are my girls." And, most precious of all, I did have a little time with Dr. Hurst, who is really ecstatic with Lyndon's state of health, state of mind, and the way he has acted as president, but who very much wants him to lose 20 pounds, and who wants, most of all, not have to be the doctor who gets questioned by the columnist and by the reporters.